Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. You've heard about the Human Genome Project. Well, now there's the Human Metabolomics Project. University of Alberta scientist Dr. David Wishart has taken on the task of identifying the hundreds of metabolites in our bodies. And when it comes to the social and economic impacts of gambling, Alberta can learn a lot from Australia. Dr. Jan McMillan is using GIS mapping and mathematical algorithms to help identify solutions to her country's gambling problems. And Trevor Council of the Alberta Conservation Association is developing an index of biological integrity for the Battle River. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Just as genes can tell us something about the potential for disease in our bodies, so can small molecules called metabolites. Only we don't know what all those metabolites are just yet. But by the time Dr. David Wishart has finished his human metabolomics project, we could be well on our way to developing a whole new method of assessing the state of human health. David is a professor of computing and biological sciences at the University of Alberta.
Metabolomics is kind of the new kid on the block. There are fields, we call them omics fields, that have been going on for the last about 10 years. One is called genomics, and that's the study of the genome. Another field is called proteomics, and that's the study of all the proteins that you might find in a cell or an organism. And then metabolomics is the study of the metabolome, which is essentially all of the metabolites or small molecules that you'll find in your blood or urine or other tissues and body fluids that are kind of the chemicals of life. And the metabolome and metabolomics are really the study of the chemicals of life.
You're involved in a project now. You're about a year and a half into the Human Metabolome Project. What's that?
What we're trying to do with the Human Metabolome Project is do what the Human Genome Project did, which was completed in 2001, about 5 years ago. So the Human Genome Project was tasked with trying to determine the sequence of all the genes and all the chromosomes in a human cell. So there's about 3 billion bases and about 25,000 genes that had to be characterized. And it took them about 12 years to do, and it cost about $1 billion. We're doing the same, although we're trying to do it over a shorter period of time, for the metabolome. So we're trying to characterize all of the small molecules or metabolites in the body. And we believe that there's something on the order of 2,500 small molecules that are in the body. These are different types of molecules that are used to make up the genes and the proteins and the tissues and the things that our bodies typically generate or need to stay alive. And we're trying to characterize all of them. We're trying to identify what they are. We're trying to figure out how many or what their concentrations are in which compartments and which tissues and which fluids. And we have 3 years to do that. And we have a team of a number of scientists covering many different disciplines to try and achieve that goal.
How are you actually doing it then? Do you have to go and draw fluids from people and look at their metabolites?
Well, it's sort of a two-stage process. The study of small molecules actually was the start to all of biochemistry. And so even as far back as the early 1900s, people started writing about and characterizing small molecules. And for most of the first half of the 20th century, that's all that biochemistry was. And then it sort of changed or transformed in the 70s when people realized you could do molecular biology and do all kinds of neat things like cloning. And we kind of forgot about biochemistry and about small molecules. So what we have to do for our first phase of the project is to relearn or rediscover what was forgotten from about 1900 to about 1975, and to track down all of the molecules, all the small molecules that were written about in different journals and books, papers. So we're calling that the backfilling process. And we've been doing that for the last year now, adding to our list of chemicals and compounds, things that are long forgotten or lost in the annals of time, to create part of the database. And then the second part is, in fact, using clinical samples, patient samples, and measuring and identifying these compounds. In many cases, these are compounds that were reported, so we didn't want to rediscover the wheel. But in some cases, these compounds are things that have never been seen or described before, and so now we have to identify them, characterize them, and figure out what their concentration is, the normal and the abnormal levels.
What is the application?
Metabolomics has the potential for changing the way we do medicine. The same sort of song and dance that people give about genomics and proteomics, where with genomics and proteomics we can maybe do new tests, identify the causes of genetic disorders, causes of cancer and other major diseases. But it turns out that studying small molecules or measuring small molecules is in fact the way we've been doing medicine for the better part of 100 years. If you go into the doctor's office and they ask you for a urine test or they take a blood test, the things that they're actually looking at are small molecules. And small molecules give a wonderful indication of exactly what's going on in the body. In fact, more so than what many genetic tests can do and many proteomic tests can do. Now, the problem has been is that the number of molecules that doctors could measure has been in the order of 10 or 20. It's a small set of tests. With metabolomics, we're going to have a list now of 2,500 molecules and technology to potentially measure maybe 300 or 400 of those all at once. And now instead of sort of getting a little slice of the picture of what's going on in your body, sort of a short biography that's got, you know, 10 words, we're going to have a description of you, a chemical description of you, which might constitute 300 or 400 words or 300 or 400 components. And we'll be able to tell you what's high or low or what's normal. And those may be able to indicate what sort of things might be wrong or what's ailing you or what may have happened to you the night before or what could happen to you further down the road. So small molecules are wonderful tools for both diagnosis of disease and for prognosis of disease outcomes. And we're just essentially expanding the library or the dictionary so that we can make more precise assessments. And we're also trying to expand the technology so that we can do this better, faster, cheaper.
Now, I understand that there's a company in Edmonton that is already working on some of this, and you do have a relationship with them, the company Canomics. What's happening there?
Well, one of the things that Canomics is doing, it's one of the first metabolomics companies to start up. They have a technique for rapidly assessing, identifying, and quantifying metabolites in urine or in plasma or other body fluids and body tissues. But their technique depends on having a library of known compounds. So right now the library is limited because our knowledge is limited. With the Human Metabolome Project, we'll have the potential of maybe expanding that library by a factor of 10, say from 200 molecules to 2,000 molecules. If Canomics or other companies were to use this library and use the knowledge that comes out of the Human Metabolome Project, then they would be able to have essentially a testing tool or a testing device that integrates either it's called an NMR or NMR spectrometer, nuclear magnetic resonance spectrometer, or a mass spectrometer, and within perhaps a minute of collecting a sample and processing it, would have a readout of 200, 300, 400, 1,000 molecules and their concentrations. And given that it costs, using conventional technology today, to get a readout of maybe 20 compounds, that might cost $500 to $1,000, and it might take a week or 2 weeks to get the results back. This sort of thing that metabolomics promises, or the tools that Canomics and other companies around the world are developing, promises to make delivery of diagnostic tests much, much cheaper And the quality of diagnostic tests much better. It would be a transformation, or as they call it, disruptive technology. Totally change the way that we do medicine.
You're just back today from your mid-term review of the Human Metabolomics Project. You finished up the backfilling phase of it. What's next?
So the next phase is actually to move forward and start actually identifying and confirming the metabolites that we can find in blood and in urine and in cerebrospinal fluid and in cells. We're also looking at other body fluids like saliva. You may even look at tears. These are all things that are relatively easy to access. And so this is another appeal for metabolomics, is that we don't have to do biopsies. We just take things that are very easy to access and not too painful to get, and essentially measure health. So what we're trying to do now is measure those metabolites, confirm what was reported in 1923 is still, you know, true today, and to confirm or correct the concentrations for these metabolites. So the forward filling process is what's going to occupy us for the next 18 months. And if all goes well, we should have the first release of the human metabolite database, or the complete collection of all human metabolites and the relationships to genes and proteins, pathways and disease, released to the public for January 1st, 2007. And we think it'll be as significant to medicine, and hopefully as significant to Canadian science, as the completion of the human genome was when it was announced in 2001.
Thank you very much, David.
You're most welcome, Sho.
That was Dr. David Wishart, a professor of computing and biological sciences at the University of Alberta and a researcher with the National Institute for Nanotechnology. David is the lead investigator on the Human Metabolomics Project, which is supported in part by the Alberta Ingenuity Centre for Machine Learning. While Canadians are just developing a gambling culture with the recent influx of neighborhood casinos and VLTs, Australians have enjoyed legalized gambling for over 200 years. So where do these people from the Southern Hemisphere rate when it comes to assessing the positive and negative impacts of gambling? That was the focus of Dr. Jan McMillan's presentation at the recent conference in Banff hosted by the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. Jan is a professor at the Australian National University and the director of the ANU Centre for Gambling Research. Jan says that Australians gamble more than anyone else in the world, so I asked her why.
Because it's there. Alberta comes close. It's the only place that comes anywhere near us. Albertans gamble about $800 per adult capita. We gamble about $1,100, $1,200. And we've had a very, very liberal gambling environment ever since white settlement. It hasn't been prohibited in Australia like it has in a lot of other countries. And in fact, most of our gambling was run by governments. And the criteria was that there should be no profiteering from gambling and that it should be for public benefit. And then in the 1970s, we lost the plot and commercialised. And that's when the wave of expansion and the wave of gambling problems started to occur.
Now, in your talk, you referred several times to a study that was done by the Productivity Commission. What is the Productivity Commission, and what was the main finding of that study?
Okay, the Productivity Commission is our big national economic think tank. They're mostly, we think, free marketeers and what we call economic rationalists, who normally would be inclined to allowing the market to grow and be more concerned about low taxation, that type of thing. And their findings from this study were quite different to anything else they've ever done. And they basically came down to the major finding was that the social costs of gambling were profound and hidden to a large part, and that in a lot of cases the social costs were outweighing the benefits. And importantly, they held the industry and governments responsible and said that the reason was policy failure and market failure, that governments were driven by the drive for revenue and taxation, and the industry, in terms of its profit-making, were introducing what they considered to be improper practices. And so it was a wake-up call for both industry and government, and it caught everybody by surprise, I think.
Now, one of the things that came out of that, you suggested, is a new policy, a containment policy on gambling. What do you mean by that?
Well, the states had to respond. I mean, they were being called to task. And so most of the states, either explicitly or implicitly, basically put a lid on their growth strategies. Until then, new gambling opportunities were being introduced rapidly. And after the Productivity Commission report, people put a freeze on the introduction of new licences, and there was a general agreement that they should pause and take breath and have a look at what the impacts were and do a policy review to see how they could address the problems that quite rightly had been identified.
Now, quite often people here are looking at the costs versus the benefits, and you've actually taken that a little bit further. What is it that Australia is doing?
Yes, we did try to sort of do an economic calculation of the costs and benefits using conventional methodologies, and we realised we're never going to get to an agreement on how to do that. The debates amongst economists could go on forever, and governments can't wait. So they've really decided that really what they've got to do is basically involve the community more. We're focusing on concepts of harm and benefit and letting the community have a say in how they define those terms. And we're looking at the effects of gambling down at a very local level, because we've found that the effects of gambling can differ widely from one community to another. Some communities seem to be very resilient and cope with a large range of gambling options without too much trouble. Other communities are really struggling and the problems are acute. And we want to know why, and we want to involve the community in developing solutions.
Now, you mentioned that you're looking at new ways to define the effects of gambling on communities, and you're using things like GIS mapping and mathematical algorithms. What do you hope to get from that? How is that going to help you?
Instead of just relying on plain economics, we're moving to other disciplines. Health research, criminology have been using GIS mapping for years to understand and inform policing strategy and the allocation of health resources, to put health resources, hospitals, ambulance services, where there are areas of need, for instance. And this isn't rocket science. It's simply taking an existing methodology and we think putting it into another domain where it's very much needed. Up till now, we've really been taking an aggregate approach to gambling problems, sort of getting up in a helicopter and looking down at the broad panorama. When the impacts are localised, what we've decided to do is we really need to get down to the local level and understand what's happening on the ground and understand where the local needs really lie. And GIS is a great tool. That's all it is. It's an analytical tool that will help us identify the areas of need and help us allocate the resources to those areas.
One of the ideas that has come up at this conference is the idea of taking a more holistic approach to looking at what the social impacts are. And you said that what you're looking at in Australia is actually the five capitals. What are the five capitals and how will they help you?
Well, it's a well-being approach. We really want communities to benefit from this. And in fact, some of the legislation makes that mandatory, that gambling must be on balance of benefit. So it's a well-being approach that looks at human capital, social capital, economic capital, institutional capital to make sure that the resources and organisational support is there, and natural capital as well, because some communities are very well endowed in terms of natural resources. Other communities, particularly in inner urban areas or semi-industrial areas, there's very little for people to do, and a club in a community like that really becomes the only game in town, and that community could be very vulnerable.
What lessons do you think Canada can learn from Australia's experience?
Oh, not to make our mistakes. That's the main thing. I mean, I think we were a bit blasé about it because Australia's had legalised gambling for 200 years without acute problems. And it was so legitimate and so well respected. Everybody gambled. And then suddenly in the 1970s and 1980s, we lost the plot. And communities started to hurt. And it took us 10 years to start to complain. So I think it is preventing those problems from occurring in the first place. Monitor the effects of gambling progressively and develop preventative problems so that you don't end up with the community as we did in Australia in 1999, where 90% of Australians who gamble said that gambling was doing more harm than good. That's not a positive response.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Jan McMillan, a professor at the Australian National University in Canberra and the director of the ANU Centre for Gambling Research. She was speaking at a recent conference in Banff on the social and economic impacts of gambling. This was sponsored by the Alberta Gaming Research Institute. This summer, the Alberta Conservation Association is studying the Battle River to determine its environmental or biological integrity. The man in charge of the study is Trevor Council, the ACA's Fisheries Program Coordinator in Lethbridge.
Well, the Battle River is in central Alberta. It actually originates near Battle Lake, and it flows eastward through agricultural land, and it flows east for about 420 kilometers to the Saskatchewan-Alberta border. The primary sport fish species are the walleye, northern pike. There's goldeye and mooneye as well. Also, there are several non-sport species in the river. There's sucker species and minnow species.
Well, if the Battle River is going through agricultural land, is that a concern for the fishery and for the Alberta Conservation Association?
Yes, we're concerned about the human activity within the drainage and the impact that it is having on the fishery resource. What we're going to be involved in this year is an index of biological integrity.
And what does that mean?
Well, basically, it's widely understood that human activity has impacted and, in many instances, contributed to the degradation of watershed health in Alberta. A widely used tool to measure watershed health is an index of biotic integrity, or the IBI. An IBI is a multi-metric approach that can be used to examine the influence of humans on aquatic systems. Specifically, an IBI approach can be used as a means of describing the health of a river and can describe and assess the structure of the fish community. The IBI has the ability to detect the effects of diverse human actions, and this includes agriculture, livestock, logging, recreation, and urbanization, all the kind of major human influences on water resources.
This index, then, is that something that's been developed in Alberta, or are you borrowing this from elsewhere?
The IBI has been around since the early 80s, and it has been used in other jurisdictions. In Alberta, it has yet to be used extensively, and part of what we're doing is we're hoping to develop an index that will be suitable for Alberta.
So using this index of biological integrity, why is it that you're focusing on the Battle River as opposed to other rivers in Alberta?
Well, the cumulative effect of human activities on the lower Battle River has been great. Flows have been altered by the dam at Forestburg. There's water withdrawals from the river. There are navigational barriers that exist, such as weirs, and just the general land use has impacted the river. Also, agricultural activity along most of the Battle River and its tributaries has resulted in degraded riparian areas in many places. In addition to all of this, the government is in the process of developing a water management plan for the Battle River. And a key part of the development of this plan is consideration of the aquatic environment, and in particular the Battle River fishery. So it has been determined that, the IBI would be the best tool to provide a good overall picture of the status of the Battle River fishery.
So how does this actually work? How do you collect the data?
The IBI methodology consists of partitioning members of the fish community known to exist into categories that describe their role. And based on fish surveys, the actual abundance of the fish is then estimated. And then the estimates are combined into a single value that describes the biotic integrity. A value of 100% would indicate maximum biotic integrity. The IBI value is related to geospatial attributes and to other factors of interest. We expect that the number of fish species to increase as the river size and distance from headwater sources increases. We also expect the relative abundance of fish species captured to change in response to watershed scale factors related to human use.
You said that 100% would be considered a good index. What would be a value that would say to you it isn't very good?
Well, first of all, a value of 100% probably doesn't exist in this in this river. The closest value would be in areas where there's still native vegetation around. Basically, a value of 50% or greater would be considered good within the drainage. But in saying that, we have to determine what that value is and basically relate it to what the river was historically like.
What do you expect to get out of this?
Well, the IBI study will help us identify the extent to which human development has increased the risk to loss of fish community integrity on the Battle River. The expected outcomes of the study include a clear quantified measure of the effects of present levels of development on the fish communities in the Battle River. Also, the IBI will provide a framework for estimating the potential of future development on the Battle River. We also anticipate that the data collected will improve the design and interpretation of an IBI for other Alberta fish communities. An additional outcome includes the establishment of set points and mitigation measures based on the level of disturbance in the watershed, which in turn is anticipated to reduce the effects of human development and to restore a healthy fish community structure into the Battle River watershed.
You have a number of people helping you with this. Who else involved in the project?
The project will be a collaborative effort between the Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Environment, and Alberta Fish and Wildlife. We anticipate our data collection to begin mid to late May, and we hope we'll be finished by the end of August.
Thank you very much, Trevor.
Thank you.
That was Trevor Council, Fisheries Program Coordinator with the Alberta Conservation Association in Lethbridge. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Gaming Research Institute, Alberta Ingenuity, Alberta Conservation Association, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Innovation and Science, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Research Council, Calgary Technologies Inc., Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, Science Alberta Foundation, Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, and the NSERC ACR Integrated Landscape Management Research Chair. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.